Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight during the first hour is Paul Ray, who was with us for some memorable conversations just a few years ago. They are available, as a matter of fact, on our website in video form. And he's with us right now, talking to us from his home near Hillsdale College in Michigan, to discuss what's brewing between the federal government and the Catholic Church. And a good deal does seem to be brewing. Paul, good evening.
How are you?
I'm just fine. Let me just begin by offering you a first sentence from a recent essay of yours.
Okay.
You have to hand it to Barack Obama. He has unmasked, in the most thoroughgoing way, the despotic propensities of the administrative entitlement state and of the Democratic Party. And now he has done something similar to the hierarchy of the American Catholic Church. Obviously, I could ask you to expound upon that paragraph, and that would fill the full hour.
I'm afraid it would. Let me start by saying that, you know, we live in what we call a limited government, which is to say a government limited in scope. There are areas that it has always been the opinion of Americans since the establishment of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that the government shouldn't touch.
I found in another of your recent essays, all circling around this same theme of
right.
the current face-off between the Catholic hierarchy and the Obama regime, I found a reference, and a very persuasive one, way back to Magna Carta, saying that's where it begins for us.
Right. No, that's exactly right. This is a kind of artifact that's peculiar to the Christian West. You won't find it in the world of Orthodox Christianity or the world of Sunni Islam, but something developed in Western Europe. In my view, it wasn't intended. It developed out of a set of circumstances, and the crucial element in it was you had a universal church and you had particular governments. You didn't have a coincidence between the territory covered by the church and the territory covered by a government. So you didn't end up with Caesaropapism because you had one pope in Rome and you had many different countries and many different jurisdictions. And the effect of it was that the distinction within Christianity between the secular power and the spiritual power was given a practical form in the Christian West that was really very, very different. And it meant that the church was always fighting for its independence from the secular power. And it practically meant that the ambition of churchmen to preach and pray freely set them against governments in such a way that they tried to hem in those governments
If you go a step further and look, say, at the English Quiet Revolution or the Peaceful Revolution, and then on to the founding of our republic, something else emerges, doesn't it? Namely, the concept that the government doesn't have rights against the church. The church has its own sanctuary, so to speak, or its own block against governmental invasion or interference. But ultimately, also, the government is limited as regards to its right to get into your or my individual life.
Yes, exactly. What happened is the church, in order to maintain its own independence, had to find allies. And it found allies initially among the barons in England or among the princes in Germany against the sort of central power. And later, it found allies in institutions like parliaments. And parliaments were based upon a principle called the Latin phrase is quod omnes tangit ab omnibus tractari debeat, what touches everybody ought to be dealt with by everybody, which was a principle of canon law used to explain why popes were elected by the College of Cardinals and bishops elected by canons of the cathedral and abbots elected by monks and so forth. That was transferred from the universal law of Western Christendom, canon law, to the particular laws of all sorts of different countries. And it provided for the calling of parliaments to parley, to talk, and to talk about public policy, but also mainly about taxes. So the church, in seeking allies and in creating allies, reinforced the independence of corporate bodies other than the church. Corporate bodies like the City of London or the City of Bristol, or corporate bodies like the Colony of New York.
And what about individual bodies like individual citizens?
Well, the same way.
That's what our Bill of Rights is basically about, isn't it?
That's right. And it grows out of these struggles, and it grows out of, you know, there's another element to it, and that is with the Reformation, you get religious conflict and a kind of civil war in almost every country in Europe. And the secular authorities then begin to look for some kind of principle that can bring an end to this religious conflict. And that's where limited government is born.
Yeah.
That is to say, that's where the government limits its control over religion and religion's control over it.
But in the crucial sentence of yours that I read just a moment ago, you speak of the despotic propensities of the administrative entitlements state. That's a mouthful,
yes.
but it's utterly relevant, not merely to your general argument, but to your analysis of the present a confrontation between state and church.
Yeah, the present confrontation turns over the fact that when the federal government takes over medical care nationally, whether you have a single-payer system or you have sort of intensive regulation from the center, it gains a lot of power. And it gains a power over all medical institutions. So it can dictate to them how they conduct their affairs. And as it happens, something like 27% of the hospitals in the United States were built by Roman Catholics, often with the help of Protestants and Jews who contributed to these institutions, to take care of the poor and so forth. And it, you know, it's part of the Catholic teaching, and in the way I see it, part of common sense, that abortion is a form of murder. So Catholics want to keep as much distance as possible from committing murder. And when the federal government takes over medical care, it can dictate to your institution that you will do abortions, or the federal government will not pay you for doing anything. And if the federal government controls the money that lies behind all medical care, it controls you. Now, look, this is part of a larger argument. When the federal government controls a substantial proportion of the money that goes to the University of Chicago or the University of Illinois or the University of Oklahoma and so forth, it also is in a position to dictate to the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois, and the University of Oklahoma in 1,000 different ways. And we've learned from experience over the last 50 years, as aid to public education has grown, that when the federal government pays a significant part of the budget of any institution, it will begin step by step to take it over and tell it how to run its affairs in the smallest possible way.
I should note in passing that you are a member of the faculty of Hillsdale College, where you are, of course, a senior professor. And Hillsdale is one of the few institutions in this country which absolutely takes not a penny from the federal government.
Right. And one consequence is we're not subject to the Buckley Amendment.
Yeah.
Which means that if a parent calls me up and asks me how his child is doing, I can tell him. Whereas when I taught at the University of Tulsa in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at least in theory, I was risking that the university would lose all of its money if I had that conversation.
Now, Paul, we've set the ground for what will now follow almost directly after a brief capitalist interlude for your direct address to the continued confrontation between the church and the government at this moment over whether the church has to yield some way against its deep inner moral convictions and allow that medical care provided through Obamacare by Catholic institutions needs to contain somehow the right for people to go and for employees to go and get contraceptive aid, including abortifacients and possibly even full abortion, though that runs against the church's precepts, the very church's identity, though you hold the church, in some sense, responsible for having got into this dilemma. That's something I've learned from reading your essays recently, which rather surprised me. I want to get on to all of that, of course, after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Professor Paul Ray, who's got a number of very important books. One of them, and it's the one we discussed recently, you can find it on our website, you can listen to that earlier discussion, is titled Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift, Montesquieu, Rousseau, Tocqueville, and the Modern Prospect. The concept of soft despotism is equivalent to the growth of the administrative state. That is to say, the state gathering more and more power over us, but supposedly doing it in a benign and friendly way. Up until this present moment in our history, medical care has been provided essentially by private insurance companies, medical insurance companies. I have medical insurance from the University of Chicago. I imagine, Paul, that you presently have it from Hillsdale College.
I do indeed.
But if Obamacare goes through fully, and a great Supreme Court test is looming within a few months, if it goes through fully, then essentially we have centralized administration of medical insurance, medical coverage, and it's centralized, that ultimate center, the state. The state is telling the Catholic Church, and it's really telling, I should think, also Orthodox Jewish congregations or organizations, and surely evangelical Protestants. I mentioned both of those because they also, I'm sure, have taboos against indulging and supporting birth control minimally and abortion maximally. But the state is apparently trying to tell them, as well as the Catholic Church, no, you've not got to provide all of this for those whom you employ. That is the great face-off. How did it suddenly emerge and blow up in our faces right now?
Well, I think it's a deliberate decision by Barack Obama.
Uh-huh.
Under the influence of Kathleen Sebelius, who's head of HHS, Health and Human Services, and Nancy Pelosi, both of them nominally Catholics. Joe Biden recommended against it, and so did William Daley, because of the trouble that it would cause. I think this trouble was deliberately sought.
To accomplish what purpose?
Well, it seems to me that this particular president represents a break from prior Democratic presidents in that he really wants to go all the way and assert full control. And he's very much concerned with getting civil society and the various institutions of civil society, talk radio being one of them, firmly under control of the administration in Washington.
Talk radio to be controlled under a revival of what used to be called the Fairness Doctrine.
Right, right. And it extends into all sorts of areas. And see, one of the irony is, look, the Catholic Church has pushed universal health care. Provision by the federal government for 40 years. You can see it on the website of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Yes, what you assert in some articles I've read recently is that the Catholic Church has definitely been leaning, has for many years leaned liberal, leaned democratic, and has leaned towards the further extension of all sorts of services from the nanny state.
Right, and look, partly...
Which makes them complicit in the trouble that they have now got into.
You know, the chickens are coming home to roost in this regard.
Yeah.
And the crucial error is to mistake charity with public provision. Charity is when you and I give our time and our money to support institutions and efforts designed to help people who are needy or in trouble. Public provision is when the government forcefully takes money from people to achieve those sorts of ends.
Well, now let me, on a role-play basis, at least take a counterposition. How can we really just trust the charity to take care of all of the indigent or all of those who are underprovided? People aren't necessarily all that nice and all that good. So maybe we do have to spread the wealth around a little, and that is the job, as the president said to Joe the Plumber, that's the job of the guys in Washington.
Well, you know, there's some truth to that, and the some truth has to do with the fact that local governments have always provided charity hospitals and things along those lines. In other words, there's been a kind of local reinforcement of it. And that's probably a good thing. The problem comes when you centralize so much power in the hands of a very few people very far away over whom you have very little leverage. You know, if something goes wrong in the operation in Chicago, I can move to the suburbs. If something goes wrong in the operations of the United States, we really don't have anywhere to go.
What do we have with regard to this particular question, namely what religious institutions are required to do when medical care has been centralized? What do we have in our cousin countries in Western Europe, or for that matter, in Canada?
Well, Canada, I'm not so sure about the details. In much of Western Europe, you have something very much like what Barack Obama is pushing.
Does that include requiring, say, the Catholic Church in France, under their very centralized government-run healthcare system, requiring the Catholic Church to provide for contraception
and
birth
control?
No, and
I'll tell you why. First, the Catholic Church in France has no hospitals. The government took them over a long time ago. You know, the Catholic Church in France doesn't own any churches either. Every Catholic church, every building that Catholics will hold mass in,
yeah, is a public institution.
Is owned by the government.
Yeah.
Which can shut them down tomorrow if it wants to. And the Catholic hierarchy in France knows that, and they toe the line. So what you have in many European countries, France being a good example of this, is employers don't pay for health insurance. What you have is single payer.
Right. That's exactly what they call the system up in, in Canada.
So the issue in this form does not arise. See, the problem here is you are asking people to pay for things that they think are murder. What goes on with it in France is that the government pays.
I was amazed.
So the direct conscience question doesn't quite come up.
I was about to say I was amazed to discover that you focus a great deal on someone high in the Catholic hierarchy who you think carries a great deal of the responsibility for the trouble that the Church is now in this regard, and it's none other than the former Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, Cardinal Bernardini.
Yes, he was a formidable man, a very intelligent man, and a very politically powerful man within the Roman Catholic Church from a very young age. And for many, many years, he was on the Congregation of Bishops in Washington, in Rome, that picked the bishops worldwide. And he had enormous power in terms of picking bishops within the United States. And so any ambitious priest wanted to please him. And he had an influence over the Roman Catholic Church greater than any prelate in the history of the American Catholic Church.
Now, with regard to abortion, he propounded a kind of theological line, or at least an ideological line, which he called the seamless garment argument, which opposed abortion, to be sure, but said abortion should be opposed, but so should various other things, like, for example, capital punishment.
Right.
And for that matter, poverty itself. All of those need to be addressed, not abortion alone.
Right. And by lumping those things together, he lumps together areas where the Catholic Church claims to have teaching authority, moral questions, direct moral questions, what you should not do, and prudential questions. For example, the question of how you best deal with poverty is a prudential question. And the Roman Catholic Church, for example, bitterly fought in the 1990s the welfare reform that was proposed that was going to eliminate aid to dependent children as a kind of permanent feature of our welfare landscape. And they fought it fiercely as if it were a moral question, when in fact the real question was, eliminating that, would it do good or do harm? Which is a political question, a question beyond the competence of the churchmen as churchmen. And it lies within the competence of sociologists and political scientists, not that they necessarily know the answer, but it's the area that they study. And actually what happened when you did that welfare reform is poverty went down because people got jobs.
Yeah.
And the people who got jobs were actually a lot happier as well, because they had a certain pride in earning their own livings.
Has there ever been an instance in which particular, at least local Catholic bishops, have yielded on the question of putting church supportive money into a medical plan that covers abortion?
I believe so, and the place that I know about, I suspect it's happened in more than one place, but in San Francisco, the city of San Francisco passed a series of laws in this direction, and there was an extraordinarily weak bishop in charge in San Francisco, and he simply caved. There have been attempts in the city of New York, and Cardinal O'Connor, not the current cardinal and not the preceding cardinal, but sort of two back, made it very clear to the mayor of New York that the Catholic Church would shut down all its hospitals in New York.
And that is just what Cardinal George has predicted would be the consequence, Cardinal George of Chicago,
right,
if this current federal intrusion goes through. I must tell you we're late right now for an update on the news. But before we get to that, I just want to put on the table the fact that lots of people argue, including some people in Congress who are Catholic, that after all, most Catholic women who are married, possibly unmarried, do practice contraception, and that we all live with the reality of abortion. It's easily available otherwise, and people aren't excommunicated from the church if they get abortions or if they publicly support abortions, as many of our Catholic members of Congress do. Therefore, hasn't the... aren't you trying to lock, pardon the cliche, I try to lock the barn after the horse has been stolen? We want to get right back to that with our very special guest, Professor Paul Ray of Hillsdale College. But first, and directly to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Paul Ray. And Paul, you well know that though the doctrine of the church, and I should make clear that you are yourself a believing and practicing Catholic, and though the doctrine of the church does rule out abortion and even contraception, but in reality, the American Catholic Church has lived with it all, looking on, if not with official approval, at least with countenance, and has done that at least since Roe v. Wade, or probably even before that.
I don't think before that, but Roe v. Wade shook the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And it shook it at a time when there was already controversy over contraception. That goes back to the 1960s. And the initial response was reasonably firm, and then step by step, it became softer and softer. And part of the story here is there was a division among the bishops. There were bishops led by Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago who were in favor of soft peddling the issue. There were bishops led by Cardinal O'Connor of New York who were willing to push harder on that question. And the consequence is the Catholic Church became really ineffectual in teaching its own people. And, you know, I can say I travel a lot, giving lectures and so forth, and I've done it for a long time. And, you know, if I'm in a strange city, I'll go to Mass on Sunday morning. And I'm much more likely to hear a discourse from the pulpit on some political question than I am to hear it on the moral question of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And let me put it this way. I was a witness to the sexual revolution. I went through college in the late 1960s. You were teaching at that time, if I remember correctly.
I almost had a chance to teach you. You were at Yale for a while.
Yep.
but you never took a course for me. I was leaving, I guess.
I didn't come to Yale till 69, so I think
yeah.
you left just before
I
transferred in. I was at Cornell for 2 years before that. But in any case, a transformation took place in American life between, say, 1960 and the present day. And you can measure it in the following way. In 1962, the out-of-wedlock birth rate for white Americans was 2%. Now it's 27%. The overall out-of-birth rate right now is 40%.
Yeah,
among
exactly.
African Americans, it's 70%. It was much, much lower in all categories in that earlier period. There has been a kind of fundamental shift.
Among Hispanics, it's approaching 50%.
Yes, it's terrible. And see, the consequences of that are disastrous for the children born into those situations. Some of them will come through it fine. Many of them will find themselves, they need fathers. I have four children, and with the two of us, it's hard to do it right with two people. I really feel for those people who are single and who are rearing children. But we've gotten into this situation by dint of, a loss of impulse control, to be frank. And that's tied up with the question of a loss of an appreciation for the virtue of chastity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I was a kid, the Roman Catholic Church taught chastity, maybe too much. I haven't heard a sermon on it ever.
Well, there's also the problem that lots of its priests, just what number of one can't be sure, don't live with a full deference to chastity.
It has in the recent past been a very serious problem. And obviously, if you don't live in accord with a principle, you have a tendency not to want to preach that principle. I have in the last 13 years never heard a sermon on chastity, and yet it is the sin, unchastity is the sin most often committed by all of us.
Probably most often mentioned in the confessional as well.
Yes, I'm certain of that. And it is a subject that needs explanation because it isn't obvious. Our pleasures speak to us very strongly.
No.
Self-control is something that is an achievement. There has to be an argument behind self-control, and the argument hasn't been made. So the truth of the matter is that the church has failed to teach its own moral teaching
at the same time
it was preaching politics.
How has it happened in that context that just now the church has taken a strong stand, or will it ultimately defer?
I think, strangely enough, it was the scandals that took place with regard to bishops sort of shuttling around sexual predators, people who preyed upon young people. That broke open nationwide in 2002.
Not only
open in Chicago in 1990.
Yeah, not only Bishop Law in Boston, but as you say, the same was probably true under Bernardine here in Chicago.
Oh, it was certainly true. And there were court cases around 1992, 1993, 1994 on considerable scale. It was true in most places. The effect of the scandal was to cause a kind of rethinking, especially among younger priests. That's one side of it. Another side of it is that the decline of the church, in a way, prepared a return for the church. The quality of the young men who are becoming priests now is considerably higher than the quality of the young men who became priests in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
There's
no reason to become a priest unless you're really serious about it.
You stunned me with one line in one of your recent articles where you said that, maybe you were quoting somebody else, to the effect that some seminaries were essentially brothels.
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, I'll give you an example. The one attached to the Catholic University of America, the Diocesan Seminary in Washington, D.C. But there were others. When I published these articles, I got letters from hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And one of the letters and emails and so forth came from a man who was worried that I was attacking the Catholic Church. This was one of the very few negative responses I got. And I sort of explained in an email back to him, no, I was actually trying to defend it against sort of corrupt practices on the part of the clergy.
Paul, we're going to pause in just a moment for another quick round of commercials. But before we do, time being rather on the short side, what do you recommend or what do you urge with regard to the present situation, and why do you urge it?
Well, I think the bishops should stick to their guns, and I hope that Barack Obama is defeated for having done this. I'm not arguing that all Catholics should become Republicans and that the Republican Party should be the Catholic Party. I don't believe that. I don't think any party should be a Catholic party, and I don't think the Catholic Church should be committed to any party. But in this particular election, given the attack on religious freedom, that is to say, the attack on free exercise, they've got to turn people out against this particular president. And if they succeed, Democratic Party leaders may do a little bit of rethinking.
Will this become an issue in the forthcoming presidential
election?
It's
going to be huge.
You think?
Yes.
But what isn't it the case, though, that most Catholics live with sexual control? That is, I don't mean with celibacy or chastity. I mean with essentially contraception and,
well,
where necessary, abortion.
Abortion. Those who attend the Catholic Church every week.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to see much of that with regard to abortion.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think you're going to see the pill being much used, which can be an abortive fashion.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church has not explained its position on contraception either, and that's the reason. I say this as someone who did not understand it at all well myself until fairly recently. And it was due to getting married to a woman who understood things better than I do.
All right. You, of course, focused on soft despotism, the term actually borrowed from Tocqueville. Is it early? Does it occur in Montesquieu as well? I don't think so.
No, it doesn't.
It's Tocqueville's term. And he worries about what he discerns as a kind of soft despotism which might begin to develop in the United States. You're convinced it has developed, and you're now really arguing that this particular intrusion into our lives and into our institutions, and you could specify many others, represents a movement away from soft despotism to at least a hardening of despotism.
Yes. This particular president is, he likes to defeat people and humiliate them.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I've got to pause right now, but let me quickly invite telephone calls. We'll have about 10 minutes for any who want to put a question or offer a quick thought. So the lines are open, 312-591-7200, if you want to get in to conversation with Professor Paul Rahe. By the way, Rahe is spelled R-A-H-E. He's got a number of very important, significant books of political philosophy, but he absolutely makes political philosophy readable and exciting. 312-591-7200. Get the calls in instantly if you want to be heard. We shall return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Paul Rahe, and we'll go quickly to the phones. First caller is Tom. Good evening, sir.
Yes. Is it Dr. Rahe, Mr. Rahe?
Yes, sir. It's doctor. It's professor.
Yeah,
please go ahead.
Professor, I'd like a couple of examples of how Obama loves to humiliate people.
Well, one of them is this issue of what he's doing with the Catholic Church.
He's humiliating the entire church?
Well, he's, yes.
I think the church has done a pretty good job of doing that itself.
The church has done a lot of harm to itself. But asking people to be complicit, asking people who believe abortion is murder to actually provide for murder, is to rub their noses in it. And that's malicious. See, keep in mind, contraception doesn't cost much. The morning after pill costs $20 a pop. This isn't a great burden on people. This is something that people can afford to pay for themselves. To make the church pay for it, however, is to rub the noses of those people.
Why would he go out of his way to do that? What's the end game there?
Well, keep in mind, he's being guided by Nancy Pelosi and by Kathleen Sebelius.
Okay.
And that's the driving force behind it.
Unrepentant feminism somehow is one of the sources of all of this.
Hell hath no fury.
Two old farts like you are debating this.
Sir, that's the kind of word we don't use on the air. not on this program. And in fact, we don't personalize. Therefore, I will resist saying anything about your incivility. And we'll go quickly to the next caller, 312-591-7200, and Ken joins us. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm. My name is Ken. I'm a Catholic, not that much practicing. But what I'd like to ask the professor is that in the coming election, how can we Catholics, explain to the people this is propaganda about a woman's right to choose and how it's my body? And I don't mean to put them down for saying that, but it's all propaganda to separate us and not let the true idea of the separation of church and state.
Well, that's a very interesting point you make. Is it the case, Paul, that feminism is of the modern insistent variety has been irreconcilable with serious commitment to Christianity? I'm not sure that is true.
The problem is there are any number of varieties of feminism.
Yeah.
There's considerable debate among feminists. And there are Catholic, anti-abortion, anti-contraception feminists who are very much concerned, for example, with women's rights vis-a-vis employment, and all sorts of other areas of life. So it's really a complicated business. But there is what you might call the free love feminism.
Yeah.
There's an unwillingness to accept that a human life has been created and that snuffing out another human life for one's own convenience is a crime. Not just a sin, a crime.
Yeah.
It's murder. One of the reasons people don't understand this is because they've not really thought about it much. And Catholics haven't thought about it much because they don't hear about it from the pulpit. It's very rare. Now, I have. I mean, in my own church here, our new pastor spoke about it a couple of weeks ago. And he was very good. I mean, and I've encountered it a couple other times in the last 13 years. But I can tell you from the letters that I've received from people and the emails and the calls that my perception that it's almost never talked about is correct. There are, of course, exceptional priests and exceptional dioceses. There's one in Lincoln, Nebraska that's apparently terrific.
You seem to have a rather pleased reaction to and a happy expectation concerning the new Cardinal Archbishop of New York.
Well, he seems to have a backbone. You know, these guys have not had much in the way of backbones in recent years, but this one seems to be tough as nails. And my sense is that the current Cardinal Archbishop in Chicago is a pretty tough character.
Yeah. I know him a little, and yes, he is. Let me go quickly to the next call, 312-591-7200, and here is Maria. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I am Catholic, and I'm very disappointed in the Catholic Church. You cannot, this issue of abortion and all the various pills and the Catholic Church saying, well, we don't want to pay for it, you can't distinguish between the Catholic Church and its parishioners, other religions and its parishioners. They are, in essence, sanctioning what Obama is saying, push it on to the insurance companies. The Catholic Church has wanted socialized medicine forever since I can remember. They have not taken a stand, particularly in America, on various issues. It's sort of like we will just turn our head and maybe it'll go away, sort of like what they have been doing with their other problems with the various pedophiles. It is very disturbing. Socialized medicine in itself is immoral. You cannot pick and choose various aspects of it. And I don't care if it's Obama or if it's Mitt or if it's Gingrich or if it's Hillary. This is what is going on. It is very, very dangerous. And it's the loss of our individuality. It's total control of the individual.
I agree with you 100%. And I think, you know, the solution to a problem like this is decentralization. The solution to a problem like this is to leave responsibility with individuals, with private associations, and where necessary, with local governments. The centralization of it means that the decision whether you or I, when we get older, and I'm afraid I'm getting older, come down with something, will be treated, is going to be a decision that's going to be made by a committee in Washington that is going to be rationing health care because it's very expensive.
Right. And they're going to decide what's important, what isn't, and what's politically correct and what isn't politically correct.
Right. And they will control our lives and they will control our deaths.
Yes. Refreshing to hear someone, from your college and you speak, because people are missing the whole point of this. You know, it's onto the Catholic religion. Well, it transcends that. It's much more than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, it's going to touch everybody. This is just one aspect of a much larger question of whether our lives are going to be regimented and bureaucratically controlled in every little detail.
I did mean to ask you, Paul, along those lines, with thanks to Maria for an excellent contribution, has there been any public reaction from the other religious bodies that I mentioned, from Orthodox Judaism?
Oh, yes.
From Evangelical Protestantism?
From Lutherans, too.
From Lutherans.
Remember earlier this year, there was an attempt by Eric Holder, Attorney General of the United States,
yeah,
to dictate to a Lutheran congregation whether they could let go a religious teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an interference. There was an attempt to interfere with this by the Attorney General of the United States. This particular congregation was letting go a woman who was a religious teacher there, and she was claiming sexual discrimination. And the Justice Department intervened in this case. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was a quaint case whether a religious denomination could pick its own religious teachers. So, you know, talk about free exercise being at issue. And here's what's interesting. The United States Supreme Court unanimously found against the Justice Department on this one.
Yeah, I think I remember the case.
Yeah. Now, I think one of the reasons is this. The current Supreme Court is made up of 6 Catholics and 3 Jews.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a Protestant on the court.
Curious. Yeah.
Okay, the Catholics and the Jews have long experience of being in the minority and, if not exactly persecuted, at least under a little bit of pressure. And so they're very persnickety about the independence of their religious denominations and about their self-governing character.
Paul, the beeper you just heard means that we have to go to the newsroom. We've got a problem here, and I want to discuss it with you privately. So would you hang in there for a minute?
Sure.
As we go to the newsroom and to Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Paul Ray, who is talking to us on a phone hookup from his home near Hillsdale College in Michigan. I should tell you, I have to say publicly, Paul, so we won't confuse people too much, and also to show the behind-the-scenes problems that one sometimes runs into. We didn't know where our guests were. They were scheduled for the second hour. They are now in the studio, but we were asking you to stay for the whole next hour, though you've got a 6 o'clock class, and of course it is now... let me see. It's now after midnight in Michigan, is it not?
A slight bit, yeah. Right. I have to get up at 6:30 to take my kids to school.
There we are. But if you don't mind, let's go for another 7 or 8
sure,
minutes till
sure,
the next break.
Fine.
And then we'll go to our other guests who are here to talk with us about the persecution of Christians in various Middle Eastern states. But let's just go directly back to the phones. 312-591-7200. And next up is Mary. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. I have a question about the medical care.
Yes.
And why people are jumping all over birth control, the Catholic Church in particular. And I'd like to know if they have the same concerns about erectile dysfunction coverage.
What an interesting question. Yeah.
no one's ever raised the issue.
Oh, I think there are a lot of people talking about it. I don't know who you're talking to, but there are a lot of people that are asking it.
Very well. Yeah, it would be the parallel.
Yes.
You know that. What is it? What's the name?
I mean, talking about contraception in 2012, I feel like I'm in a time warp of 1960.
Right. Yeah.
Are we really still having this conversation?
Yeah.
But hold on. A preliminary attempt to think this through. If you treat for erectile dysfunction, you are in fact pro-life, aren't you? That is from the sexual intercourse that would thereby occur, if no further precautions were taken, a life might be generated. So the church couldn't be opposed to that in the same way, could it?
I don't think so.
But, really?
Yeah, it you know.
Oh, is that what you think that's all about? That's interesting, because another Catholic entity actually came back and said that was a physical disability. And it was a medical issue, which I suppose now they think that, I don't know, does the Catholic Church not think pregnancy is a medical issue?
Well, they certainly think that if they're going to provide health care coverage for their employees, they're going to certainly provide coverage for childbirth.
Okay, and are they also going to provide it for erectile dysfunction?
I think they don't, but I'm not an expert on the fine details of healthcare healthcare insurance coverage.
And now that I hear you're from the state of Michigan, you know that a lot of these retirement systems in that state are in huge problems, especially in the car industry, because of these types of products that are being required and are covered. And somebody really ought to start checking out the fairness of not covering birth control for young women, and yet they are willing to control this erectile dysfunction medication for the volume of money that's being spent on it, I think would really amaze you, and it might be a future opportunity.
Well, a very interesting contribution, ma'am, and it's rather clear that Mary does not favor the position that you are advocating at the moment, Paul.
Probably not.
But let's go to the next caller. Charlotte is next up. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. Would you like to comment on Cardinal Dolan's letter a week ago, March 2nd, to the Conference of Bishops?
Yes, it's a good letter. It's a strong letter.
Yeah, he said, we did not pick this fight, but we're not going to run from it.
Right. Well, he certainly didn't pick it. I mean, they were shocked by it. It came out of nowhere, and it had obviously been planned, because a month before the decision was announced, George Stephanopoulos was pressing Mitt Romney in the debate up in New Hampshire about his position on contraception.
Which quite confounded Romney. Why do you raise this question? No one's planning anything about contraception.
Yeah, but obviously, you know, Stephanopoulos still...
He was an instructed...
he's an operative still. It came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of the story here is we would be a whole lot better off nationally if we had health insurance for major medical and no other health insurance. That is to say, if we paid for our own ordinary expenses. They're not made cheaper by health insurance, except with regard to perhaps a group of people negotiating to have the rates lower, and that's an advantage. But at Hillsdale College, one of the things we have is health savings accounts. So essentially what I have is major medical and then health savings accounts to allow me with my own money, but tax-protected or tax-free, to pay for the medical bills. And the effect of it is if I want contraception, which I don't, but if I did, I go pay for it with my own money. And the way the thing is structured, I mean, look, what do we need insurance for? We need insurance for big things that are going to destroy us. We don't need insurance for ordinary doctor's visits. What happens is we pay the insurance company and they pay the doctor. Well, if we paid the doctor, we'd cut out the middleman. It would be cheaper because there wouldn't be the administrative costs. So there's something crazy about health insurance that covers ordinary things. And, of course, contraception is about as ordinary a thing as you could imagine.
Paul, we've only got a minute or two left, and then we can at last let you go.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful to you for spending the extra time, and it's been a most illuminating conversation. But let me indulge me with a response to a last question. You are a serious Catholic, and you're critical of the way in which the American Catholic Church has been running itself in recent years. Do you... quite apart from the issue we've been discussing, what do you have to say to the major prelates of your church?
I think it's time that they should rethink their mission and return to teaching faith and morals. And the one thing I would say to them is this. If they are not obliged to speak on a political question, they are obliged not to speak on a political question. That is to say, if the question is not one in which basic fundamental morals are at stake, as it is in this question with abortion, they're obliged not to speak.
You know, I can't resist.
Don't know much.
You are a philosopher, and we've ended on an ultimate modern philosophical note. That's a Wittgensteinian comment, isn't it?
Yes.
Of that of which you cannot speak, you must remain silent.
Right, the last lines. Yes.
Is the Tractatus Philosophicus. Yes. Wonderful.
Well, good night. I'm going to go.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Hope to see you again soon. Good night. And we will pause for a quick round of commercials, and then on to some new guests who are here to tell us about a conference being held this weekend here in the Chicago area, and concerning not merely the harassment of Christians, but rather their murder in various Middle Eastern countries. Directly onto that after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Now, let us fully introduce our guests for the second half of the program. And by the way, they were here all along. There's been some muddle on the part of the security staff at the Tribune Tower, and this will be addressed tomorrow. But they cooled their heels for an hour in the outer lobby, and we were not called or not properly informed. Every so often things go terribly amiss and awry. But my apologies for that. Apologies to Juliana Taimurazi, who is the founder and president of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council, and Dr. Kamal Ibrahim, who is a neurosurgeon and an advocate for human rights, and particularly focused on the rights of Christians in Egypt, that being the Coptic Church in the main.
That's correct. Small correction. I'm orthopedic surgeon.
Orthopedic surgeon, rather
spine.
Than neurosurgeon.
That's correct.
Specializing in the spine.
That's correct.
Which takes you into neurological territory, surely.
That's correct.
What is the situation of the Copts in Egypt?
In summary, Copts are the Christians of Egypt.
Yeah.
And they are about 10-15% of the population.
They were.
Yeah. And they are still 10-15%. Mm-hmm. Government, of course, statistics don't like to say that, so they don't get the rights. But United Nations statistics, about 12%. Our church statistics is about 15%. So we talk about 15-18 million people. Through the history, we had good time dealing with the majority are Muslims. But since Mubarak days, we had a very bad time in discrimination. It actually goes back even to Nasser's days, since the 50s, 1952. And we thought with the revolution last year in January of 2011, things will change. Unfortunately, it's getting worse.
Well, there have been murders. There have been whole churches have been attacked. Have they all occurred since the most recent revolution?
Yes. More of it happened recently. In October 9th, Christians went out in peaceful demonstration, nonviolent, asking to prosecute the people who burned a couple of churches. They were attacked, by the way, by Muslim fanatics, and then the army attacked them with tanks and ended up by crushing them under the tanks, killing 28 people. I've seen some of the worst picture you can imagine, and injured about 350 people. And up till now, there is no one single person prosecuted or even one put to court for this case.
And as the Coptic churches continue to provide their services and hold their services on Sunday, are they harassed minute by minute, day by day?
Yes.
Who's doing what to them, short of burning their churches or trying to murder them? What else is being done?
The most important thing is the burning and hurting the churches and people going in. But any chance they can get to find ordinance to try to stop the service or close the church altogether, especially in a small villages where peasants live, they can very easily, the strong people in the city or the town who are Muslims, get ordinance to close the church. Yeah. That's very common.
Now, Juliana, who's with us as well, Juliana Taimorazi, you're from Iran, but you are a president of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council. There's trouble for Christians in both of those countries, isn't there?
That is correct, Mr. Rosenberg. First of all, thank you for the opportunity for being here. I was born in Iran, but I'm an Assyrian. And the Assyrians, who are also known as Chaldeans and Syriacs, are being persecuted greatly in Iraq. In Iran, they're being harassed, if you will. I fled Iran when I was 16 years old and went to Germany. Because I was being harassed, I was told that I would burn in hell for my Christian name and that I was unclean. I couldn't play with my friends. But in terms of the Iraqi Christians, since 2003, there have been a systematic ethno-religious cleansing that has been inflicted on them. Prior to 2003, there were 1.4 to 1.5 million Assyrian Christians there. Today, we have approximately 500,000 left only.
Where were they located in the country of Iran?
They were all over. They were in Baghdad. They were in Basra. They were in Kirkuk, Mosul in the north. So they lived in villages in the northern part, which is Nineveh, our ancestral homeland.
And there's surely less persecution from the Kurds in the north than there is from the Sunni or Shia in the rest of the country. Am I right?
It's different. The religious cleansing started happening from Baghdad and south, in Baghdad and Basra, yeah. In Mosul also. The form of persecution that we are faced in the hands of Kurds, it's more, if you will, it is harassment. For example, the Iraqi Christians are fleeing Baghdad and they go to the northern part. So they're asked to join the KDP, the Kurdish Democratic Party. If they do not join that party, they're not allowed to work. They're not allowed to get educated. And unfortunately, it is known that Kurds are the greatest ally of America. They are the greatest ally of Christians. That is not entirely correct. There is a great amount of money that has gone there, but not a lot of that money has been given really to the Christians. I'll give you an example. $10 million was sent by U.S. Department, USAID there, and only one well was built, $480,000. The rest of the money is gone. If they're building homes, the Kurds, if they're building homes for Assyrian Christians there, they're either so high on the hills that elderly cannot get to, or they're so cold in the winter and so hot in the summer. So there's a great deal of manipulation and trauma that is being inflicted on the Assyrians there. Women are harassed every day. They are raped. For example, I'll give you an example. On May 2nd of 2010, four buses filled with Christian students going from their small cities to Mosul University to take their final exam, they were bombed. Two people died, and the rest of them were badly injured. Nine of them lost their eyes. So those are the types of persecutions we see in the Kurdistan region.
You are a Syrian or Chaldean, and that is a variant, or rather a portion of the Catholic Church. You're considered Catholics in communication with Rome, isn't that right?
I myself, yes, I'm Chaldean Catholic.
Yeah.
However, Assyrians are either they follow the Assyrian Church of the East, or the Chaldeans are those who follow Rome, if you will, and they're Presbyterians and there are Episcopalian Assyrians there.
The Assyrian Church of the East then is Orthodox in its
yes.
connections. Yeah,
correct.
So you have both Orthodox and Christianity and Catholic.
Exactly, and they both are being persecuted. Also, yeah. Evangelicals.
Yeah. Did I get the numbers right? There were about 1.5 million, and now there's only about 500,000?
Exactly.
Where's the missing million? Where'd they go?
They have fled to Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, and you see the situation is so terrible
yes.
in Syria that there's so many that have been killed. About 2 weeks ago, there was a report that was sent to us that about 100 people that were killed, Christians, that were killed in Syria. And, you know, I have to tell you, the mistreatment of these people in Syria and in Jordan is also inhumane. So not only they have been, see, when the persecution began in Iraq, it was so systematic, they started sending letters, giving them three options: either convert to Islam, pay jizya, which is a form of tax that non-Muslims pay to Muslims during war or leave. Then our churches were bombed over 80 times. Our archbishop, the Chaldean archbishop, was killed by poison through his nostrils. Priests had been beheaded, their bodies mutilated. Kids have been kidnapped, held for ransom. Women have been impregnated, and the list goes on and on.
Would you both agree, or would you both contend that that this kind of persecution, this kind of rage, this kind of destructiveness, comes essentially from that sector of Islamic faith, which or of the Islamic population, which is given to radical extremity? Is this an expression of the Salafi sort of extremity, or does it run through all Muslims at a time of national uprising, national disorder, national tension?
There is a basic belief between the majority of Muslims that infidels, they don't deserve the same rights as Muslims.
Well, you and I have something, the three of us have this in common. We are all dhimmi.
Yes.
We are. We all possess dhimmitude, which means we are peoples of the book, but lesser peoples.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the word in Arabic is zimmi.
Zimmi.
And but the latest degree of killing, attacks, and discrimination, it clearly came with Salafism, who were under the influence of Wahhabism of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And came to Egypt through many millions of poor people who went, or rich people who are professionals who went to Saudi Arabia to work over the last 30 years. They brought back the Wahhabism and give it the new name Salafism.
Wahhabism is based in Saudi Arabia and it's funded by Saudi Arabia, so that many Muslim schools in this country are essentially Wahhabist in their basis and even in their teaching program. Do comparable problems arise for Middle Eastern Christians like the two of you in Arab-speaking areas of this country?
I would expect if teaching of Wahhabism continue, we will see it here as well.
And Wahhabism is being taught
in
many American Muslim schools.
Exactly.
Exactly, and we see that the force behind Sharia law for it to be implemented and respected in this country is on the rise. And we as Americans have to really wake up to what is happening behind curtains. And I wanted to shed some light on what is happening to what has happened previously to the Assyrian Christians in Iraq. This, what we see today starting 2003, is not new to us. Since the rise of Islam, I'll give you a statistic. Since the rise of Islam to 1800s, every 45 years, Mr. Rosenberg, Christians were persecuted in the hands of Muslims. Then, starting 1800s until early 2000s, it was every generation, every 11 and a half years, Assyrians were killed. During World War I, I'm sure you and your listeners all know about the Armenian and Greek genocide.
Yeah.
75% of our nation was killed alongside of the Armenians, and really no one talks about our genocide during that time. 1933, Iraqi government was formed in 1932. In 1933, they purposely recruited Kurds and their own army, the government did, to massacre an entire village of 3,000 people. So unfortunately, our nation is very familiar with this type of persecution. So it's not Wahhabism today that has been on the rise, that has been persecuting the Assyrian Christians, per se.
But surely there must be, within the Muslim communities of the Middle East, there must also be strong reaction against this sort of thing. There must be condemnation.
Absolutely.
That's correct. Absolutely. And always I have great respect of the moderate Muslims who really believe their own religion properly and correctly, and they believe there should not be discrimination, and all of us are believing in Abrahamic religion or origin of religion. And yes, there are many of them. And the instance or the situation in Egypt, when you see attacks on Christian and you find the other good Muslims coming out to help them out, many of them, they are against Salafism, against the way the discrimination goes on. And for those, I'm always appreciating their good belief in their own religion.
The basic question is, what is to be done? What can be done? We'll address that as we return. Right now, a necessary pause. for an update on the evening's news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
It's been a rather improvised night because of various things that did not work out according to the original plan. One other thing that was planned, Congressman Joe Walsh was supposed to be with us. He did come back from Washington early, but has developed a case of laryngitis. So he's not with us tonight. Our two other guests, Juliana Taimurazi and Dr. Kamal Ibrahim, are both deeply concerned with and deeply involved in efforts to stem and to turn back the kind of new hostility towards Christians, which is to be found in various nations in the Middle East. And we are focused particularly tonight on Egypt and on Iraq and on Iran. You're both involved, in, together with a number of other people, in an important conference that's being held. Is it this Saturday?
That is correct.
Let's talk about that a bit and invite people to come to it.
Absolutely. The conference is called Faith Under Fire, the Global Threat to Religious Freedom. This is a very important conference. Congressman Walsh will be there. Congressman Roskam will be there. Several activists from Washington, D.C. and St. Louis will be there. Center for Security Policy has organized this. And it is taking place on Saturday the 10th. From 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. If you're interested in registering, you can visit faithunderfireconference.org. That website, once again, is faithunderfireconference.org, and it is taking place in Mount Prospect at a Crystal Palace Banquets location. I greatly invite those who are concerned citizens about the plight of the Iraqi Christians as well as the Coptic Christians, and if they're just interested in learning more about this, to visit this very important event.
By the way, what's the Middle East Christian population in the Chicago area?
Oh, that's we don't have a very good statistics, but I can say that Egyptian Christian who are called Copts, it can be about 1,000 family. So I would say about 5,000 people.
Two or three congregations, churches?
We have three of them.
Three of them?
One in Burridge, and one in Palatine, and one in North East Indiana. And now we are getting a new church downtown Chicago.
Ah. And for the Assyrians?
We are a large community. We have approximately 90,000 Assyrian
families
in
the Chicago area.
In the Chicagoland area. And we have approximately seven churches, if I'm not mistaken, throughout the Chicagoland area.
Now then, let's get back to what's happening and whether anything really can be done and who can do something to rectify or to hold back this kind of barbarity. The ultimate barbarity is burning down churches, killing people. But short of that, you've been put in really second-class status in Egypt, among other places, haven't you?
Yeah, that's correct. Through the years, Christians were marginalized. Yeah. And that started with Nasser system about 50 years ago and came to be very, very strong and prominent in Mubarak's days. That you don't have president of university who is Christian, a dean of any school in the university is a Christian, the number of professors dwindling down to be Christian. We are about, even if we take the United Nations number of 10-12%, you have about 0.5% from judges are Christian, 0.5% as a leader in the military for forces or the police forces, and so on. There is a great discrimination for graduates of university to have a good career inside the university, faculty of the university, so they have to leave and go out. That's a systematic discrimination, beside, of course, the forced conversion. Kidnapping young girls, teenagers who are minors, younger than 16, converting them by force into Islam, and that's continuously we're presenting cases to international.
And is there no legal recourse against that sort of thing?
There's a lot, but the judges themselves are
complicit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And along the same way, the biggest two things we face and need to be changed are media and education.
When did you leave Egypt?
I left about 40 years ago.
40 years ago,
yeah.
When you were a very, very young fellow.
Yeah.
Way back before the establishment or some few years after the establishment of Israel, there was a sizable Jewish community as well, wasn't there?
That's correct.
It's gone completely.
Yeah, there's about 70 Jews are still in Egypt.
70. Yeah.
And there are the old people who would like to stay, taking care of the cemetery, the synagogues there, and so on. So I'm sure with time they will disappear.
At peak, there were about, I think, 50 or 60,000.
Minimum. I think it's more than that in the days of Farouk, the king.
Yeah.
Then they had a great relation. Some of my neighbors, I lived in Shobra, which is the district, was full of Christian Jews and Muslims, and all of us lived in harmony.
Years ago, Abba Iban was a guest on this program when I just started doing the program. Yeah. And he was literally with us only a week or two after the occasion when Nasser went to Jerusalem.
Sadat went to Jerusalem.
I said Nasser. Sadat. Excuse me. Nasser never went to Jerusalem. Yeah. When Anwar Sadat went to Jerusalem. But only 2 weeks or so after.
Yeah.
And we chatted about it on this program. And he said, well, I had the advantage over many of my colleagues in the Knesset because, as you know, I speak Arabic. And he spoke such a wonderful classical Arabic, but most of my colleagues could not appreciate it.
Of course.
Which is curious, sort of. It comes back as a memory. Similar harassment in established in law in Iraq and Iran both, or do they differ in that regard at all?
They are different. They're not established in law, but they are harassed. The people in Iraq, especially in Baghdad, are deathly afraid of really leaving the house, even for shopping. Still, even though they're saying that the security is slowly coming back, it is really not, especially with the pulling out of the American
Their highest political figure was Tariq Aziz,
correct,
who was foreign minister and prime minister and so on. He's just recently been condemned to death.
That is what we're hearing, and we're hearing that he's appealing.
He is a Christian.
He's the only Christian
in that close circle around Saddam Hussein.
Correct, correct. And so people continuously are harassed. They're called unclean. They're called najis. They're afraid of going to schools. They're afraid of going to work. And those that do go to work, they're taking a huge risk. So that is in Iraq. In Iran, there's a lot more peace that Assyrian Christians have there now, nowadays. When I was growing up, right after the revolution of 79, the harassment was on the rise because of the Islamic revolution that had happened. But from what we're hearing, their situation is a little bit better now.
What can be done? What are you urging? What will be urged at the conference that you're both going to?
Well, the big thing to urge is awareness. We want people to know what's going on in the Middle East, in Egypt, Iraq, and other places, in Syria. There is discrimination now going on in Syria, Jordan. Besides awareness, we need the grassroots movement here to push our Congress and our president to take a stand for the human rights of the persecuted people in the Middle East.
Have they done, what have they or we done? What's come from our own State Department in that regard?
Unfortunately, not very much. Mm-hmm. The only time I heard something of value from State Department when the Commission on International Religious Freedom came out last year, considered Egypt one of the countries of particular concern, the Secretary of State mentioned that. But really, the State Department is not taking a clear stand to protect the minorities. We have more support from the Congress, and we were able to show many of the congressmen and the senators what happened in Egypt for the minorities. And if we support human rights as a principle of the American beliefs, then we should support it over the place, including Egypt and Iraq and other countries.
The UK has lots of people who came from the Middle East in professional positions. There are lots of Egyptian doctors, I'm sure, as well as Iraqi and Iranian doctors in the UK and other professionals. Has Her Majesty's government taken any active role in all of this?
Much better than what we are doing here.
Really?
The parliament there issued a warning almost or declaration against what happened in Egypt. And there is also movement going on in the European Union for asking the Egyptian government to respect the right, especially after Maspero massacre, the one I just mentioned to you, where the tanks buzzed over and crushed the Christian.
We are about to pause for some commercials, but it is time to invite telephone calls. We'll have about 13 minutes left when we return. Any questions you want to raise about these matters, get in there quickly. For that matter, any reports from the Middle East, because lots of people of your own background are probably listening at this moment. We'd be delighted to hear from them as well. 312-591-7200. The number, the lines are open right now. 312-591-7200. Get in there quickly. Time is short, and we look forward to some participation from members of our audience as we return after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Juliana Taimourazi and to Dr. Kamal Ibrahim. And to your calls to them, 312-591-7200. First call is Anthony calling from Arizona. Is that right?
Yes, correct. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, I have a question to your two guests that are there. Growing up in the Middle East, in Egypt, you've seen Christians being persecuted and the rise of Islam against Christianity. Now that you've been in America for some time, have you seen parallel things happening over here? And if so, what should we do about it?
You mean parallel persecution of Christians in the United States?
Correct.
No, I don't think that happening here. But also, I want to warn everybody, if we leave the door open according to our politically correct attitude to have one day Sharia to apply in the United States, then really we're creating double system, and then we can see some problem with human rights as we understand it.
I completely agree as well. We are opening the door to something that we will not be able to control. The Constitution should be above all in this land and not the Sharia. And we really have to understand what this religion is about. And this is not an attack against all Muslims. I want to be very clear on this. So, for example, in Iraq, Muslims say Iraq is like the flower and Christians are like the scent of the flower. However, in this country, we have to be really careful with how much freedom is given and how politically correct we should remain.
Our thanks to the caller. You say be careful about how much we err in the direction of political correctness. What might that mistake be? How might we go wrong?
If a family that is Islamic and they're living in this country, and if their daughter, for example, decides to not to marry mm-hmm. in a premarital, get engaged in a premarital, a prearranged marriage, if you will, the family does not have the right to kill that child, does not have the right to abuse that child. And when they are in court, they claim their innocence by saying, this is how we practice Sharia. Yeah,
but this was an honor murder. We're told that's
correct.
The concept sometimes used. I can't imagine that happens routinely in Islamic and Muslim families. Seems to me that's extremely deviant and crazy. But you can use, excuse me, a cover story by making reference to religion. But surely that doesn't happen commonly in the United States.
In United States, no.
Even in Muslim countries in the Middle East?
No, it can happen, but probably in the countryside where you don't know about it or we don't hear about it, in the small villages between bosons.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, it's very popular there.
You were aware of such murders of young women?
Of course.
By their parents in Egypt?
Yes, of course. But we'll never see it in Cairo, Alexandria, or big cities. It's a countryside thing.
And you, Juliana, were aware of the same thing in Iran as you were growing up?
Women are stoned till this day. Women are stoned who decide to divorce their husbands, and that is against their religion. And they are stoned and killed when a woman decides just to leave because the husband is abusive. Even we can see that in Afghanistan. How many women have set themselves on fire as a form of suicide, and they don't die? They're deformed for the rest of their lives just to get out of an abusive situation. And we really have to be careful with, you know, to me, see, I'm an immigrant. I came to this country. I assimilated. I learned a language. I'm abiding by the laws in this land. I don't ever want my children to learn something that is against America, that is against Christianity in this country. However, how many schools and mosques are teaching their children anti-American sentiments? That is not acceptable by me, who I'm not an American born, but I'm so proud to be an American.
Let us go back to the phones. 312-591-7200 with apologies for the sore throat or the raw throat. And next up is Tom. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering, particularly in light of your last segment, why the Catholic Church seems to be silent on this issue also.
Well, I don't know whether it has been.
Well, nothing has ever, I've never heard anything preached from the pulpit about the atrocities going on in the Middle East.
Well, the Assyrians and the Chaldeans are communicants of the Catholic Church. Surely the American Catholic Church, and for that matter the Vatican, must have taken some public role in all of this.
Tom is the caller, I believe.
Yeah.
You are very correct. The reason the Iraqi Christian Relief Council was founded is because we need to educate the Americans. And that was the exact question I posed to church leadership as to why is it that the church is silent.
Is the church silent even from Rome?
They put out statements, but they're not strong enough. They condemn these attacks, but that's not enough. There isn't any diplomacy used to stop this sort of persecution. And I have to tell you, Tom, there are so many Catholic churches that I have not, and I'm Catholic myself, so many Catholic churches I've knocked on their doors. I've asked them to let me come in and talk about this and educate their parishioners, and they have been silent. That the best way to learn more about this is, especially now on Saturday, Faith Under Fire conference that is taking place from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. I urge you to sign up on faithunderfireconference.org to come and learn more. And if you want us to come to your churches, to your parishes, we will happily do so. Our network is throughout the whole country. We go everywhere to talk about this. These are your brothers and sisters in Christ that are being killed every day.
Our thanks to the caller. Quickly to another. Joe has just joined us. Good evening, sir.
I know, great show as usual. Just to remark to the previous caller, the Vatican did have a relationship with Saddam Hussein. And I want to ask your guests, one of the things that really upset me the most about our invasion in 2003 was the fact that the Catholic and Christians in Iraq had a protection with Saddam Hussein. And especially when our president at the time was an espoused Christian, went in there, I just saw nothing but bad coming of this invasion, and I see that as a result. I would like to get your guests' opinions on that and how, you know, Christianity was protected under Saddam and now, you know, what's happening now.
Juliana?
Christianity was not entirely protected under Saddam. Saddam Hussein did burn churches. He was a tyrant. He would put to death, obviously, those that rose against him. However, he was a secular and he controlled all the masses. And the reason we cheered America as Assyrians, we cheered America on when they went into Iraq, because America had helped the Kurds obtain their own region, if you will. In the northern part, we thought the Assyrians would receive the same treatment, that we would be able to have a safe zone, a region called Nineveh. That is our ancestral homeland. But in return, because the borders were not secured, Al-Qaeda came in, Iranian-funded organizations, murderers came in, and they started persecuting us. And that is something we had never expected. The neighbor turned against neighbor because of the lacks that they had in their economy. Al-Qaeda started bribing the neighbors to go kill the Christian neighbors. So to your point, yes, the situation was better under Saddam Hussein. And right now it's absolutely disastrous.
Thank you very much.
Further comment from Dr. Ibrahim.
Yeah, well, I just go back again to the Vatican. The Pope issued a statement when we had the massacre in Maspero, October 9th, but this is my issue. It is always retroactive, not proactive. We would like to see the Vatican has a stronger voice as a state and as a leader of Catholic, because we have in Egypt... Copts mean Egyptian Christian, means we have Coptic Catholic, Coptic Orthodox, and Coptic Anglican. So we would like to hear the Vatican being proactive before anything happen, show a good position as a state and as a leader of Catholic, biggest church in the world, to support the Christian of Egypt.
Is there any, or there must be some, is there much intermarriage, or was there in the old days, between Christians and Muslims?
Not at all. Not in Iran, not in Iraq.
No.
Not in the recent days. It could have been 1,000 years ago when Islam was spreading, and that for whatever reason can't happen. But in the recent days, it doesn't happen. If it happens, then somebody has to convert to the other religion. Unfortunately, conversion to Islam is wide open and welcomed. Any conversion to Christianity means that person has to be condemned to death.
Yeah.
And they submitted to the court for that reason.
And we've had some such cases that came under the judgment of American military who had to decide whether to allow, I remember such a case in Afghanistan, whether to allow a Muslim convert to Christianity to be executed, which was the judgment rendered against him in the Afghan court.
The Muslims who are converting into Christianity in Egypt are underground, are persecuted, and many of them in jail.
Let us once again briefly refer back to the meeting on Saturday and all the full detail.
Absolutely. The website is faithunderfireconference.org. It is taking place on Saturday from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. in Mount Prospect at a location called Crystal Palace Banquets. I greatly urge you to get more educated about this very important situation. Come in and voice your opinions as well. www.faithunderfireconference.org.
And I thank the two of you for joining us tonight. I wish I could come to the conference, but I'm otherwise occupied, I fear. But by all means, it sounds like a very significant and important undertaking. My guests in this second hour have been Dr. Kamal Ibrahim, who is a spine surgeon, thus an orthopedic surgeon, and who is particularly involved in the search for human rights and religious freedom for the Christians of Egypt, the various sectors of Coptic Christianity, and Juliana Taimurazi, who is the founder and is the president of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council, and both are active participants in the meeting occurring on Saturday. We will be back again on Sunday night. I trust I will get this this rasp out of my voice by then, and we'll be with you for only an hour Sunday, but I will be here live with something rather special at 11 p.m., after a hockey game, and then a full schedule for the rest of next week. Until Sunday at 11, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.